Ladies and gentlemen, I'd like to thank Mr. Kennedy for his very kind introduction. I'm sure all members of the audience will know how to make allowance for the good-natured exaggeration which is customary on these occasions. Otherwise, I would be too embarrassed. I think I would have fled before starting my lecture. Mr. Kennedy has referred to the fact that I've been associated with the Astronomical Society for quite a long time, and in view of all the circumstances, I guess there's no concealing the fact that I have been around for quite a little while. It's pretty nearly 4 decades that I have been going to meetings of the Astronomical Society, and in the process, I have made many very pleasant friends and enjoyed the meetings very much. I've also had an opportunity to watch the progress of the society, which has interested me very much indeed. And I would like to congratulate those officers of the society and successive councils during the past few years who have made what I consider a very great advance in the work of the society in organizing these general assemblies, which have been held in widely separated parts of Canada. I think that the idea of having assemblies like this in which scientific papers are presented both by professional astronomers and by amateurs is a wonderful thing. And I had on one occasion the opportunity of presiding at one of these sessions at which such papers were given. And I hope none of my friends among the professional astronomers will be upset or annoyed when I say that I found that the standard of presentation, I'm not saying anything about the material, but the standard of presentation of the amateurs, I'm afraid, was definitely higher than that of the professionals. And perhaps it's just as well that we didn't have them as professionals. It might have been hard for us to compete in the real scientific sphere. I regard it as a very special honor to address one of these assemblies, and I wish to thank the President for his invitation to do so. And it's a very great pleasure to have in the audience the members of the AAVSO, many of whom I have known very well for a long time. I was afraid that perhaps my wife gave me the elbow there for in a moment. I was afraid I'd made a rather bad faux pas after our own national anthem had been played. They were going to play again, and I mistakenly supposed they were going to do the same thing that they do in the in inaugurating our daily broadcasts in Canada, to play another national anthem of Canada. However, my wife said, "No, it's the Star Spangled Banner." Well, then I assure you that my attitude changed immediately. This is a song for which I have the greatest respect. I'm always happy to take off my hat to the Union Jack, and would hope that none of our friends here misinterpreted my rather tasteless exclamation. I hope that the members of the AAVSO will not find my address too much out of their line. Now, actually, I remember getting into a disputation about the matter of what actually constitutes a star. And I think that really a meteorite is a star of a kind, since the Oxford Dictionary says that a star is any heavenly body. And that's a term that will cover quite a lot of territory, either in the heavens or on Earth, as you know. Actually, a meteor is a variable star of a kind, rather rapidly varying, of course, and I'm sure that all members of the AAVSO have seen these objects, and I've no doubt some of them belong to the Fellowship of Meteor Observers. As far as my subject goes tonight, I want to make a slight addition to it. As stated in the program and by Professor Kennedy, it was craters of the Earth and Moon. I suggest that we change that and say impact craters of the Earth and Moon. And by way of explanation of this change, I may say that during the past 12 months, I have attended 3 scientific meetings devoted to the craters of the Moon. One was mainly devoted to the proposition that all, or nearly all, of the lunar craters were volcanic. The second meeting was based on the assumption that all, or nearly all, the craters were due to the impact of asteroids or meteorites on the surface of the moon. A third meeting, held recently in Ottawa and addressed by our eminent colleague, Professor D.A. McRae, was concerned with the very interesting suggestion that icy conglomerates have played an important part in the formation of the lunar surface, and that at least some of the lunar features are due to a process similar to that which has formed the Pingos of the Canadian Arctic. The successive brainwashings to which I was subjected on these occasions caused a certain amount of mental confusion, which reminds me of the following story. The analogy isn't entirely complete, but there are echoes, I think. Three elderly professors, somewhat hard of hearing, were traveling on a train near London, England, when one looked out of the window and said, "Is this Wembley?" The man next to him said, "No, it's Thursday." And the third man said, "So am I, let's have a drink." Now, this mental confusion is just typified a little by this story, but which passes over to some of us in this field of lunar craters, is, I think, in part due to the effort to explain all aspects of the lunar surface as due to the same cause. Actually, I don't think we should be surprised if there are more than one cause for various features on the moon. We know that certainly so on Earth. We also know that nature seems to be rather fond of nicely rounded objects. You find them everywhere. And so it's not particularly surprising that there should be more than one process molding the surface of the moon. However, I think it's only fair to say that a procession of very distinguished scientists, including Gilbert in the last century, Beringer, Dietz, Baldwin, Urey, Kuiper, and Shoemaker, have presented very convincing evidence that at least a considerable proportion of the craters on the surface of the moon are due to a meteorite impact. There is also pretty good evidence that some of them are due to other causes. But just to avoid, again, getting mixed up too much on this matter, I'm talking tonight about meteorite craters on the Earth. By confining our discussion, I think, to this kind of craters, I hope we will do a minimum of violence to the principles of logic, and at the same time, I hope to present some interesting analogies between features on the Earth and those on the surface of the moon. Now, I'm going to begin the illustrations by showing you a few terrestrial craters. Now, I don't think I have to go into any detailed explanation of this one. It's the well-known Beringer crater, 3/4 mile diameter, about 600 feet deep, and the best known and the one most valuable for study of all we know in the world, because it's the least damaged. We don't know how old it is, possibly 50,000 years, but it really is a wonderful work of nature. This is the Wolf Creek crater, rather smaller, half a mile in diameter, and it's what you might call a halo crater. There are halos of that general character around many craters of the moon. This is the Talamzane crater, about 1.25 miles in diameter in northern Africa, and this perhaps has a more lunar look than any of the others, because the not only the crater itself, but the surrounding landscape also is suggestive of the moon. Now, the next crater is a very interesting one indeed. Now, this is not an impact crater, but it is so much like impact craters that I was able to pass this off successfully as a new photograph of the Beringer crater to a number of my scientific acquaintances. Actually, it's the Sedan crater made by an atomic explosion, and as far as we can tell, and as far as we know about such craters, they are identical in physical form with meteorite impact craters. Well, now, in the next set of slides, I'm going to show you just a few lunar craters, not many, and you will be able perhaps to draw some of your own conclusions as to the superficial resemblance between them. Now, this is a rather useful photograph because it shows so many craters of different kinds. One, I believe, over 100 miles in diameter, and all kinds of small ones. And if you look at some of these, I think that you can see the general resemblance to the Beringer crater. It would look quite a bit like this one here, I think, or this one, or any of these smaller ones. Now, actually, the Beringer crater is smaller, I think, than any of those that clearly shows in that photograph, but its similarity is certainly very marked indeed. Now, this is a diagram prepared by Baldwin many years ago. These are simply clay models of craters. This is supposed to be a lunar crater, and this is supposed to be a terrestrial volcano. And Baldwin's idea in presenting this this diagram was to show that the great majority of lunar craters are actually not similar at all to volcanoes. Perhaps if we see the next slide, we may get another illustration of this. Now here, you have two supposedly impact craters, here and here. And here you can see something which might be a lunar volcano. It has a little caldera in the center. And it may be a lunar volcano. Whatever it is quite different. It is quite different from the other craters, as are these other little lumps on the horizon, on the photograph. Here is another well-known diagram. It's been known for many years, and it's simply the relationship between the diameter, the logarithm of the diameter, and the total depth in feet. Among meteorite craters, lunar craters, and explosion craters. Explosion craters like the one I showed you, but mostly a good deal smaller. And as you can see, they all lie along a similar line, suggesting that they're all due to a similar cause. In other words, that they are all some kind of explosion craters. Now, in following the subject further, I should say that for many years, the Beringer crater was the most important and interesting crater in the world. And then in 1950, Dr. V.B. Mean of the Royal Ontario Museum here in Toronto learned of another crater in northern Quebec and spent some time studying it. And the next slide will show this crater, and I would like to say just a few things on the consequences of its discovery. Now this is a photograph of the New Quebec crater. It's 2 miles in diameter. The rim rises to a maximum of about 500 feet above the plain. The lake in the center is about 800 feet deep, so that the whole thing is about 1,300 feet deep from the rim. A very magnificent object indeed. And instead of showing the very beautiful photograph of it taken by the Royal Canadian Air Force, I'm doing what most amateur astronomers do, or most amateur photographers do, showing a picture I took myself. It's just two pictures put together. They fit only moderately well. We planned to land in the crater with a small airplane, but we're unable to do so because of the ice, so we had to climb the bank here from a nearby lake. It was quite a climb, all right, especially for somebody over 30, but... nevertheless, I think the original discoverers perhaps exaggerated the difficulties of getting there just a little bit. It was really a very enjoyable expedition. There's one more picture we have of this. This is the same crater, and this picture taken at the same time by another member of our party, and it shows rather well, I think, the character of the surroundings and the crater itself and its circularity, which is very marked indeed. This is a diagram prepared by Dr. Peter Millman, also quite a number of years ago, in which he showed the similarities between these two new craters, Beringer Crater and New Quebec, and certain craters on the moon. This occurs, of course, only to their external characteristics. Now, one of the consequences of the discovery of the New Quebec crater was that it seemed, since it was found in the Canadian Shield in the wilds of northern Canada, where very few people had ever been, that there were probably a lot more of them, and that if we would only look at the 3.5 million photographs which are in the Canadian Air Photo Library, that we would find many more craters of this kind. And indeed, a search of this kind was started in 1955 at the Dominion Observatory, and it has been going on ever since. Now, one of the things that we found out very soon after we looked at only a few hundred thousand of the photographs, and that was that undamaged craters, relatively undamaged craters of the kind of Barringer or New Quebec, were almost non-existent. And that if a search such as we were undertaking was going to be significant at all, we would have to be prepared to look for the vestiges of craters, remnants of craters. We would have to place ourselves in the position of an archaeologist or a person who's studying the early man, of being content with the little finger bone or the jawbone and try to reconstruct the whole skeleton from it. And that was the next step in our search. Now, I might, if I may, outline very briefly the characteristics of craters which might enable us to decide whether one is a meteorite crater or not. Now, the surface form, it is as you saw there, with the strata up tilted and dipping away from the crater, brecciated surface, but it was quite obvious that we wouldn't find that kind of thing in very old craters. It would all be reduced by erosion. And so our real effort from a theoretical point of view was to study what the underground structure of a crater like this should be. Now, these studies were carried on partly at the Dominion Observatory by Dr. John Rotenberg, whom many of you know, and by Dr. Shoemaker at in the United States Geological Survey, and by various other persons. And I think that it's necessary to leave a few things out in a talk like this, so I'm going to leave out any of the mathematical details, and simply show you the model of what a meteorite crater would be, both above the ground and below. The next slide will show that, I think. Now here you see this is a typical crater of about 1.5 miles in diameter, and this is a combination of Rotenberg and Shoemaker and Dr. Innes on the basis of actual observation. Now, the thing that I think you can all see very plainly is that the external features that look so prominent and so magnificent in a crater like Barringer or New Quebec are very inconspicuous indeed, and that most of the structure is taken up with the shattered rock here. This is what we call brecciated rock, completely shattered, and then cracked rock underneath that, extending to a distance of the order of the diameter of the crater itself. And most of our search, I have to say this, most of our search has been concerned to look for underground structures of the type of this, to see if we could somehow, by geophysical methods or otherwise, find objects of this kind. There are, however, a few other significant things about such a crater. One is that the great pressures which result from the impact produce some very high density forms of quartz, one called cozite, one called stishovite. And nowadays, finding cozite or stishovite in the vicinity of such a crater is considered by some people as virtual proof of its impact origin. Another thing that occurs when you get very heavy shock of this kind, if one examines the crystals, the various crystals, particularly the quartz crystals, under a microscope, one finds results of the shock in the form of microbrecciation of crystals, and this is now considered as an extremely important diagnostic feature, and several major laboratories in Canada and the United States are carrying on programs of investigation along this line. Some melted rocks are found. Sometimes there is a central uplift in the crater, like the mountains which you see in the centers of some of the lunar craters. And also in the search that we are carrying out, we put quite a lot of weight on a general impression of artificiality, a sort of incongruity with its surroundings and inability to explain them on general geological principles. Now, the next set of illustrations which I'd like to show you are of some of the craters in Canada which we have examined from the point of view that I have spoken, that is, the study of the underground structure. So we'll go back then to the slides, and we'll first show the Halkett crater. Now, this crater is about 17 miles north of Kingston, Ontario. About all you can get from this photograph is a general impression of circularity. But as soon as we saw it, we found that it showed some indication of a raised rim. And while it is covered over and nearly filled in by Paleozoic sediments, we still thought it was a pretty good prospect for investigation. Now, we carried out a number of geophysical investigations of it, which I shan't go into here, since I want to speak about them in more detail in connection with the next crater. But we finally got down to drilling in the crater to see whether we would find any of this broken rock, which you saw, I think, in the last diagram. The locations of the drilling points were here, one was there, one was here, and one was here. And the next slide shows some of the cores which we got. These are cores showing the sedimentary rock with which the crater was filled. And here are samples of the broken rock which we found underneath. And it's rather interesting that in the first two cases, which were within the rim of the crater, we were able to predict within about 50 feet exactly where the boundary would be between the sedimentary rock and the brecciated rock. And the third one, which is on top of the rim, we couldn't predict at all, of course. And all that we could say was there would be a rather shallow hole. And we had a geologist in our party, and he made fun of the idea that we could predict at all. And even though we had come within 50 feet, one of these was 700 feet and the other was 400 feet. Well, the third one, which we predicted to be a short hole, was 65 feet, and we were quite satisfied that that was within the errors of prediction. Now, this is a model of the crater as it showed up from the various holes. Here's hole one, there's hole two, and here's hole three on the rim. Very interesting thing indeed. Dipping well, this, by the way, dipped well below sea level, had that particular part of the country. Now, the next one that I'll describe is the one in Algonquin Park, which Mr. Kennedy has already mentioned. I may say that the Halford crater is quite nearby, not very far from Toronto. Anybody that wants to take a look at it could find it quite easily. The Brent crater, the next one, is more remote, but still, anybody with a reasonably good car that doesn't mind a few bumps can get there fairly easily, or anyone who has come into a little money could hire a little airplane and take it up there. There are two lakes, very nice to land on, and I'm sure it would be a very interesting expedition. Mr. Beringer, by the way, the Beringer who discovered the original crater, actually did that thing. He got a little plane up there and took a look. I think he was quite pleased with his expedition. Now, this is the Brent crater. It's almost a twin, as far as size goes. It's almost a twin of the New Quebec crater. You can see the two lakes inside of it, and then there's quite a lump in the middle here. But all that is Paleozoic sediments, and we had a number of expeditions there looking for surface breccia, carrying out geophysical excavations, and doing drilling. And the next slide, well, I'll run them through rather quickly and show you what we found. Now, here was one of the first things we found. We thought it most interesting because this was some what we call float breccia in the bed of one of the streams, and it's just kind of material which you would expect on the underground part of a meteorite crater. Then we carried out a magnetic survey of the crater, and you can see how it's outlined here, and the area of the crater is very much less disturbed magnetically than the surrounding country, and that we believe was due to two causes. One, the sediments with which it was filled, which are non-magnetic, and the other, the fact that the magnetic rocks underneath the sediments were broken up and their magnetic poles disoriented, pointing in various different directions, so that the total magnetic effect was that of a material of low magnetic susceptibility. Well, the next slide shows the results of some seismic work, and I think we'll just refer to the top one. Here we have the indication of quite a deep basin filled with material with lower seismic velocity than the surrounding Precambrian rocks. Now, the real payoff, I think, as far as the geophysical observations were concerned, were the gravity observations, which are shown here. These are gravity contours, and it will be seen there that the gravity gradually decreased toward the center of the crater as though it were filled with material of a lower density than the surrounding rocks, and this we consider to be partly sediments and partly the broken up brecciated rock, which is a much lower density than ordinary rock. The next slide showed the results of some drilling observations. Now here again we predicted accurately that we would find this brecciated rock underneath the sediments, and this was some that was found near the edge of the crater at a rather shallow depth, and then one in the center. And this one was in the very center of the crater, and this hole was about 3,000 feet deep, and we encountered the first brecciated rock almost exactly where it was predicted, at the order of 900 feet. And you can see that some of the rock has been melted here, and it has a pumice-like form in here and here. Whereas after you get down a ways, instead of our geological friend said, oh, well, that's just volcanic material. But if it had been so, we calculated that as we went further, we should find more of it. This was not the case. As we went deeper, we simply had brecciated rock, and the melted rock disappeared from view. Now, the next slide shows a model of the crater as determined from the 10 holes which we drilled across the diameter. And there you have it. It's a crater, I'd say, somewhat larger than the Brent crater, with broken rock which goes to a depth of about 3,000 feet. And while not everyone agrees, our own feeling about this these observations was that they almost, if not entirely, proved its identification as a impact crater. Well, now the next one that I'm going to show you is the prize of all. I should say it was found by Dr. M.G.S. Innes, who I think has been more responsible for more of the hard, accurate work done in this program than anyone else. He's a simply magnificent observer and a man of tremendous energy and enthusiasm. He's ahead of a division there, by the way, one of the divisions of the Dominion Observatory, and he once lost a staff member because he expected this man to do about a third of the work that he, Innes, would do himself under similar circumstances. And, of course, all the rest of us knew that was a perfectly unreasonable expectation. But anyway, this gentleman left the staff as a consequence. I'm not quite sure how much I'd like having to keep up to Innes myself if I were a member of his staff. It would be a pretty rugged business altogether. Well, this is the so-called Deep Bay crater, and it's called Deep Bay because it's a bay of the it's a bay in the Reindeer Lake, which is a large lake about 200 miles long. Now the crater itself is about 7.5 miles in diameter, with some indications of a raised rim. And the depth of water is approximately 700 feet. The rocks are very much broken up all around the edge. And here again, anybody who would like an interesting vacation, I think that's one of the nicest places to go that I know of. It's just absolutely fascinating to see this thing, and it's not very difficult. You only have to go to Lac La Ronge by car and then spend a few hundred dollars with a small airplane to get into the crater. If you're a good walker and used to canoeing and so on, you might get into it without that, but you'd have to cross the Churchill River on the way, which would be a bit of something to do. I hope before too long there will be an actual road actually into this crater. Well, now, we have done a good deal of geophysical work on this crater, but I don't think it's necessary to repeat it, the same kind of work we did at Brent, but I did wish to show the gravity observations. Now, those were made by Dr. Innes personally on the ice in winter at a temperature of about minus 30 or minus 40 below zero. And at that time, we hadn't done those things, and that was considered quite a stunt. And he wired home the results to us. We were very, very interested indeed. But once we saw this gravity profile, we had very little doubt as to what the crater was, and we predicted that it would be partly filled with sediments because we found some evidence of that around the shore, and partly filled with brecciated rock, which we later investigated by drilling. Now, I haven't got any slides of the drill cores. We've actually put down three holes there, and found almost exactly what we expected. But this diagram shows the model of the underground structure of the Deep Bay Crater as prepared by Dr. Innes and compared with that of Brandt and Holford. And I think the comparison is very instructive. And also you see the gravity profiles in each case compared with the actual underground structure. And I think they're very instructive and significant. Now the next one, I put the light on occasionally to see where I am and also to give you a change. Since we can't hand around coffee every few minutes, that helps. The next one is one which, by the way, was discovered and investigated by an astronomer whom you all know. That is Dr. Ian Halliday, assisted by Art Griffin. And it was almost completely an astronomical venture. Dr. Innes gladly offered him the use of their gravity apparatus and instructed them in their use and found them indeed very apt, so that apparently an astronomer could be a geophysicist quite easily if he wished to do so. We will show you this. Now this is West Hawk Lake. It's a little bigger than the Chubb Crater, than the New Quebec Crater. 3 miles in diameter instead of two, but it may be the original depth was smaller. Now this is in a very complicated geological region where the gravity has a very high regional dip, so that it required some very pretty mathematical analysis to arrive at the result. But Dr. Halliday and Mr. Griffin went there in the winter in the snow. And fortunately, it's right beside the Trans-Canada Highway, so it's not difficult to get there. And they got some kind of a motor toboggan, which every once in a while would get bogged down in the slush. But they were able to make a very good gravity survey of the thing. And the next slide shows the result. Now, this is even prettier, if anything, than the Brandt gravity profiles, and left no doubt whatever in our minds about the character of the thing. We said, yes, it's a crater filled with sediments with brecciated rock underneath, and if you will give us the money to do the drilling, we'll show it to you. Well, Dr. Halliday is a very persistent fellow, and he was able to get the money and do the drilling, and while I'm sorry to say I haven't got any of his cores to show you, nevertheless, they were exactly as he predicted, and I think the next slide... I thought I could show you the next slide, the model of the crater, but I haven't got it. But it was almost exactly the same as Brandt. And I thought it was a really brilliant success for two scientists who had never done this kind of thing before. Well, now the next one, this will get monotonous, I guess, but I'm sure you it wasn't monotonous to us. Some of these investigations were the most thrilling things that I have ever been involved in. And great excitement when the results came in from the drills, and all kinds of troubles. The drilling people, you'd think, having drilled all over the Canadian Shield, that they could do a small job like this without getting into difficulties, but they had all kinds of troubles. Once we told them that they should be careful about gas. Sometimes you'll get a little natural gas. And their idea of doing this, their precautions, was to hang a lighted lantern in the hut where the drilling things were, and they thought, well, that will show all right if there's any gas. Well, it did. they had a quite a puff of gas that lasted about an hour, and it filled the hut and blew it to smithereens with the men in it. And fortunately, nobody was killed, but they lost their eyebrows, and one of the men lost his nerve, and I don't blame him. He was a local man who was helping the drillers, and he thought it was, I think, the safest job in the world because the hole was only that big and you couldn't possibly fall in it. But after this explosion, he said, that's enough for me. And not only that, but the release of the gas interfered with the farmer's well on whose property this was being drilled, and we had endless trouble. He had to all water by a truck for the winter. Then he tried to drill another well, and it was had nothing but salt water in it. And finally, we had to get all kinds of experts in to tell us to where to drill a well that would really have decent water in it, and we succeeded in doing so at a very large expense, which we would have preferred to put towards the investigation of other craters. Incidentally, we got pretty unpopular. We got pretty unpopular with some of the financial people in the government. They said, what are you, these people are always wanting more money to drill. Well, it didn't seem to get any further than sort of anguished protests. We were persistent, and they still kept giving us a certain amount of funds. And it's still going on. As a matter of fact, I would like to pay a tribute to our government officials who supported us. In a really marvelous way, although sometimes they said, well, it seems as though you're going in pretty deep here. Well, now, the next crater, which I want to show you, is Lac Couture, and it's about 90 miles southwest, south-southwest of the New Quebec crater. And I'm rather interested in this one, because it's the only one of all the craters that we have studied which, by the merest chance, I happen to find myself. All the others were found by young students, by Dr. Innes or Dr. Halliday or somebody else. But this one, I don't exactly put any property tag on it, but still I've been very interested in it because I did first find it. Now this crater, Lac Couture, is 10 miles, approximately 10 miles in diameter. And you can see it's generally circular form there, but at the time this photograph was taken, the crater was filled with ice, and so its complete form is not shown. I think in the next one you can see it a little better. This is simply the same photograph with the ice painted out. Now, I realize that many people would regard this as an illegitimate device. But we wanted to see what it would look like without the ice, and we couldn't photograph it again, not in any reasonable length of time. So we got a young lady who had quite bright, quite sharp eyes and stereoscopic photographs, and she painted out the blocks of ice, just leaving the rocks. And here you can see the very interesting circular form. And you get a central part of the lake, about 6 miles in diameter, completely island-free. These things like this aren't islands; they're just spots on the negative. Negative. It's about 400 or 500 feet deep in the center, and entirely surrounded by this ring of islands. So, in 1953, in connection with studies of various other craters, we went there. We went there to take a look at it firsthand. We weren't very optimistic about finding much information because almost all the information we'd got before were by geophysical methods and drilling, and we just went with our geological hammers and looked around on the surface. Now, I guess that slide is turned around. Perhaps that could be put up on edge. The others don't matter. This is the general character of the terrain. Here was our camp about 2 miles from the lake, and here was our plane. And An ancient Grumman goose, pre-war, but a great old friend because it didn't make much noise. I mean, you could go a long way without being too tired in it, and it had comfortable seats. And while it was a little bit large for landing on the islands and that sort of thing, this was overcome really by the skill of the pilot, who was really wonderful in maneuvering the thing, both on land and in the water. And it's quite a thing to bring a plane like that into an island landing, a rocky landing, when the wind is strong. On one occasion, this was in the lake near Chubb Crater, the pilot saw that the plane was in danger, and I never saw anybody act so quickly in his life. He took off his pants and threw them to one side in the plane and leaped into the icy water and was able to prevent the plane going on the rocks. Now, about the only things we could look for in this play, in this crater or this plant, this lake, were broken rocks around the edge, and samples of, we thought perhaps they'd be samples of Paleozoic rocks, because we would naturally expect that this crater would be filled with Paleozoic sediments, and since there were glacial motions in that vicinity, we could expect perhaps that the Paleozoic fragments would be found on the shore. Well, now, we did find some very interesting shattered rocks. This is one example. And this is another example, and there were many examples like this. And while, of course, there are a great many ways in which rocks can be shattered, these were enough different from those we found in the surrounding rocks to make us feel that perhaps we were getting some evidence that might be worthwhile. Now, here is an interesting factor. Now, this one is up on its side, too. I don't know how they happened to come that way, but suppose you could turn that one up. Now, this has a curious dim kind of an effect, as though it were taken under water. Well, now, the reason it has that effect is because it was taken under water. Now, I don't mean that we were underwater. We weren't any scuba divers or anything, but all these rocks are underneath the water. And you can see a very interesting fracture pattern there of a rather smooth, flat surface in which the rocks are fractured in this very interesting way. Well, all this made us suspicious, and so we were just about to leave the crater and go on to another one. And then it suddenly occurred to me that we'd spent a lot of money getting up there, that we might never be there again, and that perhaps we'd better stay a little longer. So after a little argument in which I had to kind of put down my foot amongst the others, they said, well, if there's any democracy here, we move on to somewhere else that's more interesting. But I said, no, we're going to stay here. So we sent the pilot out to get some more gas, because we were getting out of gas, and that's a bad situation to be in country of that kind. I'm telling you, there aren't any gas stations. So we sent him out to Bavungasuk to get some more gas, and we all had a sleep, which we needed rather badly in the tents, and we hoped he'd get back all right. There were some rather nice-looking Eskimo girls there, and we were afraid he might be held up a little. But no, he came back in a surprisingly short time, and so we all piled into the plane, and off we went to one of the islands where we'd seen some of these shattered rocks. Well, then pretty soon, Mike Dentz, who was one of our people from the observatory, he picked up a small piece of rock, and he said, this looks like brecciated rock. And we looked at it, and we said, yes, it does. It's pretty small. Well, then Alvin Cohn, who was with us, also picked up another one, a very small piece. But we didn't find any more there. And then we went along to another island, and then I found a boulder of breccia. I think it showed here. Yes, I think you can see it. It's outlined here, and the character of it is shown by the lumpy, knobbly character of it. And if you break off a piece, you see at once that it's brecciated rock made of many different kinds of fragments. And I went to report this to Mike Dentz, and I said, Mike, come and see my boulder. Oh no, he said, I'm sure that's of no consequence. Come and see my boulder. Well, the upshot of this was that. We found a great deal of this stuff, I think many tons, and if we could have brought it home, why, it would have been quite a load. But it was all in a certain part of the lake, brought there apparently from the lake bottom by the movement of glaciers, which was quite obviously from east to west. And we loaded as much of this stuff in the plane as we could, after having great arguments with the pilot, who said that the thing was overloaded before it ever left Ottawa, and he couldn't bring home all the rocks in the Canadian Shield. However, we managed to bring home about 400 pounds of it, and we still have it. The next slide. This is some of the brecciated rock. I think you can see the general character of it. We don't need to dwell on it. I'm afraid I've got this out of focus here. Small fragments of all sizes embedded in a matrix. And there were many different kinds of this breccia, some of which showed the effects of heat. Well, now, we weren't able in any way whatever to account for this except as a result of meteorite impact. And so we now regard this as a reasonably probable example of another meteorite crater. Well, now I must try and keep going on these, if you'll bear with me, I won't spend quite so much time on the others. The next one is one of the most interesting of all, the Clearwater Lakes. This lake is 20 miles in diameter, and this is about 15. This lake has a ring of islands in here, which were supposed to have various origins. But in the long run, we decided that what these were breccia from presumably an impacted explosion. And, of course, these would be not many tons, but quite a number of cubic miles of this material. There's a good deal of controversy about the nature of the material. Some of our Canadian geologists think it's volcanic, and they have something on their side, but we think not. Now, actually, the islands in the very center of the lake are exactly the same materials out here, whereas we think they would be different if it were volcanic. And There's quite an argument going on about this. Now, here's the kind of country we were in. This is one of those islands of Breccia here, going up several hundred feet. You can do some quite real mountain climbing on this. The boys got me up in one place where I didn't know just whether I could get further up to the top or back. And finally, they grabbed me and pulled me up, and we got home all right. But along this shore, there are many rocks that will simply fall apart if you hit them. And they give every impression of being subjected to shock. Various scientists have studied some of the crystal structure of the rocks, and they, again, give evidence of microbrecciation of crystals, which suggests the intense shock which you would get in the case of a meteorite impact. This is simply the gravity pattern for these two lakes, very similar to that of Brent and Deep Bay, another piece of evidence which points to their impact origin. Actually, by a number of wangles, which I won't go into in detail, we managed to get a drilling rig up there and did quite a lot of drilling, and we found some very good rock breccia in the west leg, as you can see here. Looks very much like that we found in the other craters. And it was rather shallow, however, and underneath it was found simply cracked rocks, which are shown in the next slide. And these went down quite deep, again suggesting that we were that this was an eroded remnant, of a crater, and we were just seeing the bottom part of it. Another thing that was found at Clearwater was shatter cones of this kind. And rock with that kind of a shatter pattern are considered to be considered to have been acted on by heavy shock. And some people, Dr. Dietz, for example, regards this as almost an infallible indication of an impact site. We don't go quite so far as that ourselves, but we consider the evidence interesting nevertheless. Now, the next one, this is on the same expedition, by the way, the Couture and Clearwater. Now, this next one is Manicouagan. And this is a very interesting feature, about 40 miles in diameter, outlined by these circular lakes. And the character of the brecciated rocks is almost exactly the same as at Clearwater, the one that I just showed you. And in the center, there's a sort of a mountain, like the little mountains in the centers of the moon. And the whole area here is covered by this breccia, which has apparently been subject to great heat. And very similar, almost identical with that at Clearwater Lakes. Now this is one of the cliffs, breccia cliffs, and this is our plain. So you can see it's quite a high cliff because the cliff is a little further away than the plain. Very beautiful scenery in this place. It's a sort of a little universe in itself. Right now those circular lakes which you see are being used as the reservoir for a large hydroelectric power. Development, and it's a great matter of great regret to us that that they will cover up a lot of the interesting geological sites. These show some of the brecciated rocks along the shore. Now, when we got here, some of the boys wanted to climb those cliffs, and I decided the better part of valor was discretion as far as I was concerned, so I simply sat on the beach below the cliffs and collected these rocks without ever moving from one place. There were so many of them, and you can see here large fragment embedded in a matrix with a number of smaller fragments, and here is a very interesting piece with a very great number of different fragments. Here's another pretty good one, and there are tons and tons of this stuff. Well, anyway, we regard this as a probable meteorite site, but our geological colleagues do not all agree with us. The next one, there's just one more of this particular series. They were getting pretty near to the end of it. The next one is a place called Carswell Lake, and it's distinguished not by any very conspicuous thing, but by a ring of sandstone and dolomite sediments, which are up-tilted all around, tilted away from the center of the crater, very much like the strata in the vicinity of the Beringer Crater. This is 18 miles in diameter, quite a massive thing. We have found shatter cones in the middle of it, and we haven't been able to explain the up-tilt strata in any other way except that at an impact site. Now, this slide reviews these various, this slide reviews these various craters we've been speaking of. Here's Holford, 1.5 miles in diameter, New Quebec, 2 miles, Brent, 2 miles, West Hawk, a little over 2 miles, Lac La Couture, about 10 miles, 8 miles to 10 miles, Deep Bay, 7.5 miles, Carswell Lake, 18 miles, this one 20 miles, 15 miles, and this one nearly 40 miles in diameter. We'll now go on to just one more, which is quite different. Oh, this is something which I would like to show you. It's rather interesting calculation, and that is this. How would we get the energy to melt all that rock which we found at Manitowoc and at Clearwater? And I made some calculations on the basis of quartz-like rock and found this. After using Baldwin's estimates of the amount of energy required to produce craters of various diameters, we made the calculation for craters of this diameter, 30 kilometers, 100 kilometers, 300 kilometers, 500 kilometers. We get the impact energy here, and we get the impact lava, that is the material melted by the impact, on the assumption that 5% of the impact energy could be used for melting. And then this gives the lava depth in meters if we assume it is uniformly distributed over the floor of the crater. Now, I don't mean to say that it would be, but it just gives an idea of the amount of stuff you get. Well, for 30 kilometers in diameter, you get a lava depth of 58 meters, which is quite a bit. For 100 kilometers, 213. For 300, 672. For 500, we get a kilometer of impact lava over the whole thing. Now, this is an aspect of the subject that's being studied now. I don't want to make any special claims for it, except that if you can allow a reasonable amount of the impact energy to be used for melted rock, you can get an awful lot of melted rock. And this is about the size of, order of size of Mare Imbrium. And, well, something makes a nice smooth covering over the bottom of that crater. Perhaps some of the others here can tell me better what it is. I was looking at my friend over here, Mrs. Cameron. Now, the next thing I would like to speak about very briefly is the Great Hudson Bay Arc in northern Canada. The next slide. This enormous arc here is 284 miles in diameter, and it's almost perfectly circular. If you draw a circle, if you find the center out here and draw a circle, it is so close to a circle that it hardly departs very far at any point. And this is Precambrian rock, Precambrian gneisses, what we call Precambrian basement. Well, now, these islands, which hug the shore all along for 430 miles, they're all Precambrian sediments, more recent Precambrian rocks. And I remember some years ago, I happened to be flying over the area at about here, and I was very much impressed by the dip of the sediments. All of them dip toward the center of the arc, and some of these sediment dips are shown in the next slide. Here they are. This is the shore over here, and you can see how all the strata dip away, and there are several others. Here they are again. This is a very good one, actually. They're quite high cliffs on this side, and they just grade down to beaches on this side. Here's another set, and here they look as though they're actually climbing the bank. And when you come up, you think, oh, well, they'll be separated from it, but no, they actually do climb the shore over there. And probably these others were part of this bank also ashore at one time, but were presumably separated from it later by erosion. It's an interesting thing that the Hudson Bay Arc is almost exactly the same size as Mare Crissim on the Moon. And we had some photographs at Ottawa. They were taken for quite another purpose. And in this case, the sunlight terminator cut this actually in half. And when you looked at the picture of the moon taken in that way, it looked almost exactly like the Hudson Bay Arc. And it's the only thing I've ever had against my friend Malcolm Thompson, that in some way or other that photograph disappeared. Otherwise, I'd be able to show you a picture of it. But anyway, I think you can fairly understand that if the moon were taken at a different phase, you would simply get a circle of that kind. Well, I want to speak now just very briefly about certain craters in the United States, which are called crypto-explosion craters or crypto-volcanic structures. And I'm going to begin at the wrong end. Usually you show your observations and then draw your conclusions from them. But in the hopes of being a little clearer, I'm going to show a model of these things. And first thing, if anybody wants to cry out against it, why, please get up and say something. Actually, the impact process could be envisaged as something like this. Here's the meteorite striking, and it compresses the strata, if this is stratified rock, in this manner. And the compression is very severe. The compression is very severe. And the rock must react from the... It must decompress. And indeed, the decompression is in the form of a very violent explosion, and it's the decompression which forms the meteorite crater. And the meteorite crater, when it's first formed, is like this. You can see the strata, imaginary strata up here. They've been strained beyond the elastic limit, and the rock has been thrown upward. Most of it comes back into the crater, but some is thrown outside. Well, now, if you go down further and further into the stratified rock, you will come to a place where the decompression is not quite strong enough to break the rock into small pieces. It may fracture it to some extent. And so that you will get something like this. Well, then, if after many years this crater is eroded away, you may get it eroded away to this level, and you'll get something like this. You'll get a sort of an uplift here, out on each side. There'll be a sort of a circular trench with breccia in it. And it appears that these cryptovolcanic structures or crypto-explosion structures can find a logical explanation of this kind. Baldwin was in favor of this. Boone and Albritton was the first one to suggest it, and he was very strongly of the opinion that that was what happened. And Dr. Shoemaker has made extensive studies of these objects, and he is convinced that the same process is at work. Well, there are quite a lot of these in central United States and western United States, and they have been used in rather interesting ways to compare the conditions on the Earth with that on the Moon. Next slide, please. This, by the way, is one of these so-called crypto-explosion structures, and this is really, I think, a rather thrilling picture. We've used all kinds of things to... We've used our ingenuity in every way we possibly could to find criteria to distinguish these craters. We never thought of trying to find a place where little cloudlets would make a perfect circle like that. But that's actually what happened in the case of the recent Nordlingen, which is 15 miles in diameter in southern Bavaria. That's one of the earliest of these so-called crypto-explosion structures. Another thing characteristic of these are these shatter cones, which have already been mentioned in connection with some of the other craters. And these are found in many of these crypto-explosion structures. This one is at Wells Creek in Tennessee. This is another one. This is a giant shatter cone published by Dr. Dietz and considered by him as very strong evidence in favor of an impact site. And here is something which will, I'm sure, surprise some of the Canadians. And these are some very beautiful, some of the finest I've ever seen, shatter cones, and they're found in the Sudbury Basin, Canada. And Dr. Dietz has recently published a very interesting paper in which he explains the whole Sudbury area as due to an ancient impact which was strong enough to set off secondary volcanism. One of the things that has puzzled us about the crypto-explosion structures is that they do have this knob in the center of them, this central uplift, and there are a few explosions, ordinary explosions, done in the province of Alberta by our Defense Research Board, and it's interesting to look at them in this connection. Now, this one is 10,000 pounds of TNT. This one, 40,000 pounds of TNT. You can see it's a very nice crater, looks very much like Beringer or very much like the Sedan crater, but it has no real uplift in the middle. This one is 200,000 pounds of TNT, and there's a very, very slight indication of an uplift in the center there. And the next one, which is a very interesting one indeed, This is what it looked like. It was the largest chemical explosion ever set off, I believe. A million pounds of TNT. And this is what it looked like afterwards, with a large uplift in the center, which we'll see in another slide. Here it is, in a color photograph, very kindly provided by my friends at Suffield Experimental Station. And the next one. Now, this is a photograph I took myself, and actually it happened that they covered this up with plastic in the late fall so that it wouldn't be eroded away by the winter storms. And anybody that looked at some of the craters on the moon will see quite a resemblance between this little group of peaks here and the lunar craters. I'm not claiming any particular significance for that, mind you. Now, the next final slide shows that this is a sort of an anticline of rock. And one of the things we're hoping to do next month is to go out there and get suitable equipment and excavate this and show its relation to the surrounding material. Now, there's one other thing I would like to say, and I'll endeavor to do it as quickly as possible, and that is some recent work by Shoemaker and Company and by Ralph Baldwin on the geologic ages of the maria of the moon compared to that of the earth. And their arguments go in this way. I'm going to read them in order to get over them quickly. A, if the rate of formation of maria craters is known, it is a simple matter to estimate their ages by counting the total number of craters. Now, the rate has been estimated by Shoemaker and Baldwin by extrapolating to larger sizes the observed rate of meteors which are falling at the present time. Now, that's a pretty big extrapolation, of course, you'll see. Another way is to count the number of cryptovolcanic structures in the central United States, which is a pretty stable body, a stable area, and to assume that they give a suitable rate for the formation of craters. Assume that, for example, that the Earth was subjected to the same bombardment as the moon. And therefore, if you can get the rate in central United States where these cryptovolcanic explosion structures are, then you can apply it to the moon. And the age is derived in this way, vary from about 2 billion years to about 4.5 billion years. Now, if we may criticize these methods, we might first compare them to estimates of the duration of marriage from the number of children produced, assuming a uniform rate. Well, that would be a good way, I think, if we could assume uniform rate, but we know that the rate's not uniform. It's usually larger during the early years of marriage. And I think that there is something to be said for the idea that the early years of the solar system might have been more productive of impacts of this kind than the later years, because the impacts are produced by material which is floating around in the solar system, and as time goes on, one would expect it to get swept up due to the gravitational attraction of the various bodies in the solar system. So that assumption of uniform rate formation of craters is at least, I think, doubtful. Well, secondly, we may suggest that extrapolation from known meteorite falls is a doubtful procedure, likely to lead to order of magnitude errors. It's hard to say whether the ages will be too great or too small, but they could at least, I think, be out by a factor of 10. I don't see how one could ever use an extrapolation of that kind without admitting a large source of errors. Now, thirdly, the use of observed meteorite craters is doubtful, since the proportion of discoveries to original impact is not known. Reasons for thinking that the ratio is smaller than our friends believe are given in this next slide. Now, you don't need to put the lights off. I think this is perfectly visible without the lights being off. Well, now, if you think of this as a geological column here, and if you can think of a part of the Earth's surface which sunk and was filled with sediments and subsequently rose, then these sediments, when it was at its lowest ebb, these ones up here would have had these craters in them, shall we say. If you think of the craters are too closely bunched together, just spread them out in your imagination. Well, as the erosion takes place, then these will disappear, of course, so we may call them the phantom craters. Well, then the ones underneath here, we can't see, we have no means of getting at them. So those are the buried craters. The only ones we have any chance whatever of finding are those which intersect the Earth's surface at this point. And here, we might indicate, say, that we'd find all of them, but the chance of finding all of them, I think, is very slight, because mostly they'd be covered over by soil, by glacial deposits, and concealed by other kinds of structures, so that even here, even if you said you could find them all, you only got a tenth of those in that diagram, which are actually intersected by the Earth's surface. Well, I think it might well be that you would have to divide by 10 again and go to something like 100 and say that you could only expect to find 100. Well, now, in the work to which I referred, they assume, I think, that they have found them all or most of them, whereas it would seem to me that there could be doubts about this. And if that is so, then the age of the Maria, instead of being counted in billions of years, could very well be counted in hundreds of thousands. And this is a very interesting thing. It's only the studies of this kind are only in their infancy. They will certainly be stimulated by the new observations of the moon, which are now being made by various satellites. And I think not only in this particular aspect of the study of lunar craters, but in many other aspects, we may expect extremely interesting and valuable new observations. I thank you very much.